So with that, let me turn the table over to Pedro. I've already sent to everyone an email that sort of gave a little bit of the bio and history of Pedro. Not only is he a PhD graduate of our program, who shortly after finishing his PhD organized the symposium and seminars 20 years ago, but he has a longer history of involvement with the Media Lab as well as our department here, and was a leading student activist in the anti-fascist effort in Portugal in the early 70s that led to the 1974 revolution in Portugal, which, as he says, was a bloodless revolution, relatively, compared to a lot of things that are going on nowadays. And Pedro's always been more of an activist concerned with the politics of technology than I. It's been a nice balance, I thought. I thought it would be good to inject a little bit more of that discussion with an international flavor in our debates about where are we and where are we headed as computing begins to impact so much of what we do in ways that reach beyond any particular project. So with that, I'd like to turn the table over to Pedro.
Thank you, Joe. Let's see if I can get this. Thank you so much. Thank you for coming, and thanks, Chris, for your welcome. It's actually quite a feat, you know, for me to have the pleasure of with the inaugural session. They had the three former heads of the department, including, you know, Bisha Hears, Larry Vail on the Iran, and now Amy, also giving us the pleasure of being a discussant here and welcomed by Chris. I can't claim like Napoleon, you know, songez du haut de ces pyramides 40 siècles vous contemple. But I can say, you know, we got 25 years looking, gazing upon you from the top of this discussion. But the idea is not, well, in what we achieved in the past. The idea is how did we learn from that, and how we should now face the challenges that we have, you know, for the future. So I will share the slides if I can to start right now and quickly moving, because I would like very much to be able to have some time, not only for the discussants, but also for the audience. So I'll probably, what I'll do is I'll have to probably cut a big chunk of my talk, and that will be a promise from other sessions, but I'll try to at least convey and leave some meaningful, you know, comments that you can take some use of it. The first thing that I wanted to remember is that actually 20 years ago, this was one of my, I think, my final talk. And the title, as you can see, is World in Battle by War and Poverty, What Should We Do? Well, you know, it looks like 20 years later, not much new on that ground. We still in a world in battle by poverty and war, that they said. But it is a different world, and it is a different challenge. And now the issue is not about whether technology is important or not. That discussion is done. We don't have to redo it again. Everyone now is into technology. But that causes maybe a different kind of a problem, because maybe we are forgetting that some of the ways we deal with technology are probably not the most appropriate and adequate. And so I put these little challenges, you know, the paradox. Bish was the one that told me that thesis should be about paradoxes, otherwise, duh, you know, technology is good, duh, you know, information is power, duh. You should look at things that are bizarre, that are strange. That will require you to try to get an interesting explanation. So, what is at stake? Well, you know, what is the cost of inequality? Can anyone give me a one word cost of inequality?
The healthcare costs?
Healthcare problem. Another word.
Yeah.
Inequality has no problems?
Lack of freedom.
Lack of freedom. More.
Social cohesion.
So, okay. A consequence, something that it happens derived by inequality.
Rebellion.
Rebellion. Violence. Crime. Unrest. Now, does that have a cost? Well, it does. For the people that rebel, for the people that get in the middle of the process, for the people that have unrest, and for the people that have to deal with the implications of that. So we should look upon the cost of inequality, and that is pretty much similar to the cost of sustainability, is that it just becomes a society that goes into a spiral inequality is unsustainable. Now, I'm not going to spend time on that, but you will come to a later time to question my conclusion. But I will take that as an assumption for this talk, is that we cannot allow us to just go on promising that we're going to have equality, promising that we're going to have, you know, a solution for things in a right tendency, and then in fact, as we will see here, even the mainstream institutions that are supposed to dominate and guide us recognize that the past decades we are going to a spiral of inequality. So that's why I used this idea of using the cost of free, because it is an interesting collection of paradigm about our society, whatever. But I will tell you, you know, a little Portuguese joke, because it is hard to translate. In Portuguese and Portugal, the values of the Salazar fascist dictatorship that led to colonial war in Africa was God, country, and family. Those are the values that were instituted by human values. Well, my goodness, God, country, and family. That sounds like something that wiped out. But today we have a joke in Portugal, because the word God is spelled Deus. And with a little A before, it comes a Deus. So our joke is that now the values actually haven't changed much. We just added a little A before God, country, and family, so that it says, goodbye, country and family. That's how it means, adeus, parte família. So that's the joke about what happens with the change of values in society since we evolved. Now, you don't have to believe me. I mean, we have the supposedly national, international institution that we built after the Second World War to try to create some sense and never repeat again the tremendous disaster that we suffered back then. And this guy just said, you know, in a meeting, you know, today man is just a one misunderstanding and one miscalculation away from nuclear annihilation. Well, I actually think that he's being very kind. I don't think there is any misunderstanding. I think there's a lot of arrogance. The idea that you can micromanage the levels of violence and the sequence and evolution of it. And again, I'm not going to discuss this here. Good knows where that would lead us, because my concern is to try to tackle what actually we can with science and how can we make a difference. But yet, we cannot plan for cities and then next day they will be bombed and disappear. So, you know, does that make any sense for us to be learning very hard how to build a city and then just be totally unaware that what's going to happen next if we don't aware about what is the other vision? So this is why, you know, I enjoy this great alliance that I did many years ago with Joe. We used to tease each other saying that, you know, Joe said, well, you contribute to put me looking at these larger picture things, but meanwhile, you know, I said that Joe helps me to keep my feet on the ground on how actually to implement these small things that actually can do. So it has been a wonderful, you know, trip, and I'm very grateful to this relationship we established, and of course for what else I could learn from the department. Now, cost of freedom. First, the cost of freedom. I told, and I will say my students, to challenge me on this statement. Find me one single right, one single freedom that was granted, that was offered, and that was not conquered to fight. It's a challenge. Bring it on next session. I couldn't find it yet. So what is the cost of freedom? Well, there is a lot of things going on technology, which seems to be for free. Free search on Google, free software, free access, free things. Now, for many, many years, there's a lot of people that are actually saying, well, that's not that much free. There is this very interesting work that happened on television, BBC, in 2010, of this woman, Alex Kuposki, that did a whole series about that, including a total piece about that. One of my own PhD students, I'm proud to say, that was on the first tackle on the idea of debating the cost of free from the point of view of the technology components, about the models of business and the models that were being implemented. And there has been a wonderful price of free, which is a similar thing, the cost of free. That was a documentary about a Nobel Prize winner. So I just wanted to not claim that I'm the one who invented cost of free, challenge, but it is something that we ought to use as a good framework to look upon this. And so some of the examples of the research that I'll try to briefly cover here, and then we'll have other time to expand, that I will try to be talking about here. Now, you forgive me, I will move fast over some slides, but you'll get the slides, so don't worry. I don't have to take pictures and so on, but do if you want. But you'll get the slides and you get further documentation, further publications that have a little more in depth and detail, but I cannot, of course, say everything here. So the first thing is, like, we have a promise of market economy. Okay, let's get a little reality check. In the market economy, a free market is supposed to have free competition. Ability that anyone can start a company, or start some business, and enter the market and compete. Well, that's the promise that we've been hearing for decades. We hear that we are the market economy. So what is going on? Well, look at the 2008 World Computer Desktop. Microsoft. Look at the platform share, because it is wider concept than just computers. That includes also smartphones. Microsoft. Now look about the market share on the search engine in a certain market share. Yeah, Google plus Google. Now, what about in 2020? Do you have a little trend? Well, Google stays and increases. Now, is that just a USA thing? Well, let's see. Three main blocks: China, Europe, and US. China has their own kind of a Google, which is the Baidu, I think, the name. Europe is pretty much aligned with the trend of the United States. Now, let's look at online shopping platforms. That is something tremendously a jump that we had, a leap in the last ways of dealing and doing business. Is there competition? Sure there is. But look at one, Amazon. Now, is this something only for technology industry? Let's look at the ranking of all kinds of industry, all kinds of companies. And let's look at the top 10. Apple, technology. Saudi Arabia, oil. Not technology, oil. Microsoft, technology. Amazon, technology. Alphabet, that's the other name for Facebook, technology. Google, sorry, Facebook. Then, that is a kind of a equivalent way, of the Chinese version of the same. Tesla, that is a bit of manufacturing, a little bit of classic industry, but, that is always extremely connected with technology. Alibaba, well, that's a kind of Amazon for China. And then we have finance, on the 10th, which is interesting. So, what does that tell us associated with the trends on inequality? 20 years ago, we had this slide on, because this is a slide from 2002. And that shows that actually there has been progress, but the progress has been much larger for the wealthy countries, OECD, than for the others. What happens when some go faster than the others? Well, the gap increases, inequality increases. Now, is that something that happened only 20 years ago? Well, let's see. A report 2017, 2008, 2019, OECD. The social economic divide has been on the rise in Europe over the past decades. That's the statement, you know, from the report. The gap between rich and poor have grown in more than in OECD for the past two decades. Well, that's OECD. Now let's talk about the International Monetary Fund. Globalization has also a dark side. Lurking behind it has a larger growing chasm between rich and poor, especially in countries. Another report from the deputy manager of the IMF. Income inequality has been rising in many parts of the world in recent decades. Now, just keep reading, decades. So this is not a conjunctural issue. This is a trend. And in the past decades, what policies have we had? Well, can we blame this on technology? That would be very nice and convenient. You remember these discussions that were so thoughtful brought about by us, by Bish and Larry and Aranyan, about Bish, that a generation of planners were kind of skeptical about using technology that could actually dehumanize the process, planning process. Now, that kind of argument, we had actually since the 1980s, and we had solved it by the 1980s, but that was a different setup. Why? Precisely because we had a mix of training on engineering. So we knew, as we will see, that technology, computing, was unstoppable. So the issue was not, shall we use it, shall we not use it? It was going to be used, because anyone that did not use it was going to be overwhelmed. So the issue is, how do we control and harness and control the technology development, and also how it is used and deployed? Now look at the 20 years after the report on the United Nations on 2018, Biden said, well, technology can have wonderful things for humankind, but can also bring inequality and more violence. Well, this is a cop-out. Then what makes a difference? It's so convenient. Then, of course, people say, well, that technology is neuter. The issue is who uses it and how you use it. But some people say, well, then let's go back to see if technology itself is part of the problem. And we should not cop out on this question. We should face it. So is technology per se to blame? Well, in 1993, we closed that argument. And you guys can read the documentation. And we can show that actually our model is being validated. The fact is that the model that we have was basically to go into the characteristics of the attributes of technology itself. Now, this was something that I published in 1993. I used it on my thesis, but that's a 93 research that I presented first actually in UMass in a conference. So what was these attributes? Well, we introduced the concept of cognitive leaps of technology. First, there was voice, and everyone, you know, would have a means to talk and hear. The only issue is, of course, artificially, you can impose. Women are not citizens. Slaves are not persons. But they have voices that they could be used, so it has to be a social construct to stop them. So technology intrinsically was biological technology. And that came a nice sentence that was attributed by Walter Reason, that democracy cannot go behind the human of the reach of human voice. But then came broadcast technology. And that seemed amazing because it increased the reach of Human Voice, radio and television, tremendously. But that brought intrinsic inequality on technology itself. So there you could say technology itself was to blame. You could say that. It wasn't just not the matter of use, because even a nice person creates a television station and a radio. And the one person that has the microphone is the one that speaks and has the voice amplified. All the others that are sitting in front of the vision, they can blabber against the television. No one else will hear, but the person will be on the room, the same degree. So technology during the broadcast era was actually in itself bringing intrinsically inequality. So in order to create equality, we had to do exactly the opposite. We had to artificially, we had to create a social construct that would bring back equality into the intrinsic attributes of inequality of technology. For instance, representation. The one that has a microphone should be representative of the ones that are not with a microphone. Rotation. Not always the same person on a microphone. And then we can bring a little bit of more equality about the terrible thing. Now, that's what we identified in 1993 and 80s, is that the emergency of microprocessor, fiber optics, and satellite. These three characteristics define our thesis, defines the attributes of our current era. Now, a lot of things has been now done about AI. Well, I came here to MIT in 1986 to do artificial intelligence. When I came to the department, my first draft of the thesis was intelligent multimedia system for public participation. But at the time, as Bish told in a past session, it was not so obvious for the department. So you guys didn't invite me to put a chapter on the book on there. But actually, it was amazing how even without that kind of debate and discussion, there was an insight on the department head, and they have already a low community and technology conference there, which debate a lot and raise a lot of very interesting issues. So the department caught on. And that's why I proposed in my last session as a discussion of the three, you know, amazing speakers that we had, that actually this department is specifically better equipped than many others, or probably most of other departments in academia. Because we have a strange thing that it's very hard to find elsewhere. We have here engineers, we have here architects, urbanists, sociologists, historians, social scientists, political scientists. And I hear them all say, I'm a planner. In Portugal, if someone had said, eu sou um planeador, people would laugh. What does that mean? Because urban planning is done in school, economic planning is done another, landscape planning is a different one, transportation is done in Geneva. They do not consider this the same field at all. So here, you guys have something precious and important. And I fear that we are again losing sight of that. Because I see again a little signs of ghetto, the urban science crowd, I see, well, we need focus, I understand that. But please, 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 talk to each other and cross boundaries, because that's the secret of how this department can contribute, and we badly need that contribution. So that was, you know, 10 years ago. I'm not gonna dwell on that. That you will have documentation, you can read, you can, of course, contradict me, but we keep our answer, we stand by our answer. It's not technology per se today. Because the attributes and characteristics of technology today, they are symmetric. A microprocessor is as good to receive as to send, as to consume, as to be a productive tool. Fiber optics, my goodness, speed of light, flash news, it works as fast download as upload. So if you offer, being offered a higher download speed to consume, that's an artificial construct by the provider. And wants you to be able to consume a lot from there because they also sell services and content. Hence a big debate here that was done on the Obama administration about what they call net neutrality. Long gone, unfortunately. bring it back, because that is part of the argument about regulation and how we can do it. But why did it fail? Why are we always one step behind the big companies? Well, many years ago, there was this very nice human development report by UNDP. I say, no, that was created by market pressures, not the needs of poor people. That's like a left person likes to hear, you know, oh my goodness, it's market's fault. And, you know, market failure, so, you know, let's deal with that by regulating the market. Well, looks like a nice idea. But is it just market pressures, or is it market policies, or, you know, something else behind that? So again, you know, I'll move very quickly to show actually that actually the idea of free market competition is a wonderful idea. And I'm very glad to come here with people that actually know more than that about that than me, so that I can evolve on this debate. But me, I was forced to learn political economy because I had to do a revolution and had to face what model do we want to bring it on. We don't want to rehash the same things that the dictatorship has been doing. We took 48 years to be able to do a revolution. 48 years. Portugal is a lazy, back down country. But it was not just more or less bloodless, Joe. The revolution, we didn't kill one single person. There were four people dead. All of them were by the secret police who were panicking when we surrounded them and they start shooting people. And even then, we didn't shoot them back. And I'm very proud to say that because that's another lesson as a sideline. That's another lesson. Look at the places where you get the revenge. Look what happened in Ireland, look what happened now in Israel. Go see, look what happened in Ukraine and Russia. At some point, when you start this dynamic, it's like the egg and chicken. At some point, the generation doesn't know who is to fault because it doesn't matter. They shot my parents, they shot me, I shoot them back. It's much, much, much easier to get into a war than to get out of it. That's a lesson I learned, and I'm very proud that we actually didn't fall into that trap in Portugal. We have now, we exaggerate a little bit. We even pay pensions to the fascist secret police. That's a little extreme. You know, we paid pension instead of jailing them for life when they had killed people. Portuguese army bombed with napalm, Africa. Napalm was not just the Vietnam War American army. We bombed Portuguese army. So when I was incorporated in the army, I said no. I made a manifesto say if I have to take a weapon, I will take the weapon on the side of the African liberation movements, not to kill them. And I'm very glad that actually I had never had to actually fire a weapon myself, but I had to stay hiding from secret police for 2 years. But I beat them. We won. We made a revolution. And that's the other thing I told on the first session. It may sound a little bit arrogant, but I'm in this game not to be a protester. I want us to win and make a world better. And not just say, oh, okay, let's do our part. No. We have to do more than our part. We have to make it work. And the only way to work is to be, you know, within the reality. And what is the best tool for us to understand reality? Good science. So, what happens then to the free market? Well, the problem is that, as I learned from Omar Razaz's classes, free market has a little hidden assumptions that people, the great defenders of the free market economy usually try to forget and not talk much about it. Which is, to have a free market, you have to have free, complete, and incitation information. Otherwise, how do you know about competition? If someone is offering a better product and cheaper, I don't know about it, then it doesn't work. So that is an assumption. And that assumption didn't exist for many, many years and still doesn't exist. Zero transaction costs. The cost of entering the market, the cost of entering the market and exit market, it does not have to be like you have a supply and demand, that's very nice, or something, have a demand, then it comes you get the supply. Well, okay. Zero externalities. It's very nice that you have someone, like a pig farm in Portugal, where you just use the water from the river, then you turn back all the dirty water from the pig farm, and then the community pays. but they don't include that on their course. And so on and so on and so on. So, this is what I did after learning these things from a Mars class. I want to say, that is very interesting. Actually, the information technology revolution actually creates conditions for us to actually much closer to these assumptions of the free market economy. Look at this, information free, completely instantaneous. Not there yet, but we have internet. We can Google things, like we use Google as a verb, as a verb. It says something about it. We should say search. It means something that we use that as a verb. It tells us like there is something wrong about the competition. Transaction costs, well, it's certainly much better now with the ability to use some virtual, you know, goods and commodities. Social costs, well, we can say it is better that we can count the externalities. We can make better evaluation of the cost of these externalities and regulate that they should be internalized. And that's, I think, that I learned, and I hope that we'll hear Omar on November 9th, that he's been working about on the international setting. How do you internalize for make that those externalities are actually taken into consideration? So, the current international revolution on technology should have brought us much closer to, you know, the free market. And we don't see that. We actually see one thing that a professor from Portugal came to Sloan School at MIT and gave a talk saying, it is interesting, it looks like the capitalist is the most anti-capitalist itself because it says, competition? No, sir. I want to have my own, I don't want competition. I don't want, rules are for the others, not for me, and so on, and so on, and so on. So there is this perversity about a system where actually we have this lip service about free market, and then we have policies and practices that actually tend to be monopolies. And, you know, to move forward because we are getting and running short of time, I will, you know, skim through some of these examples that I have to go quickly to what are some of the problems that we identified in technology. For instance, there was this great whistleblower, Francis Hogan, that said, well, you know, Facebook is using hate speech because it drives profit. There is actually someone that wrote, I'm sorry, I can't quote the name, I'm a person terribly academic, I can't most of them remember the sources to cite, but someone said, it is a sad world when our most brilliant students that get the best paid jobs are to find a new way to lead people to click on ads. It's a sad world when those are the best paid jobs. That should say something about the perversity of the system that we created. So, you know, the issue is, we talk about there is social networks. Well, that doesn't mean no more. That it doesn't happen. In Brazil, I have some friends that were saying, it doesn't matter that Bolsonaro has the control of the media like television because we have internet and we have WhatsApp. And we can discuss on WhatsApp. Well, it was very nice until the committee of entrepreneurs or, you know, businessmen poured in $150 million into Facebook to buy millions of messaging WhatsApp. And suddenly the activists realized that they were actually not a network. They were trapped in bubbles. When they would talk again, this is a lie, this is a fake news. Well, they would go on their bubble. The only person that would get to all the bubbles was the guy that paid to Facebook to spread. And then there is another part that the social scientists and political scientists know very well, but people here sometimes don't realize it. It's that setting the agenda, that's rule number one in politics. What happened is that the fake news made all the left on Brazil to have to defend, it is not true, they said it was a pedophile kid because of something in school for talking about sex in schools. It was not even the candidate that had done that kid. It was obviously not a pedophile kid, but they spent the rest of the time debating that it was not a pedophile kid while Bolsonaro could not talk about economy, not talk about this plan, not talk about anything, agenda setting. So technology is wonderful, the way it is framed, because we think it's a network. We keep telling this is a social network, social media network. That is not true. Look at Twitter. It is following. Of course, you can follow the follower, follow, but it's followers. And now, does that mean that technology is set that way? Well, that's what the companies want you to believe. But we saw that on the proof that we did in 1990s and 93, done and done. The attributes of current technology is symmetry, microcomputers are as good to produce as to receive. We are the perfect network infrastructure. Each node of internet is equal. And if it is not, it's because you are artificially putting something to it that has nothing to do with technology. As the way you develop technology, the way you construct it, the way you organize it. And so we are into this thing where we get to crazy things like, for instance, Twitter and Facebook starting discussing on themselves, you know, who's gonna be the best behavior about censoring Trump. Trump was by then, on these slides, still elected president without, that was before the Capitolium thing, whatever. He was expressing his opinions, of course, a lot of us, including me. You know, we consider that outrageous. But that was his opinion. And Twitter said, we determined that it's in the big public interest, you know, to you know, allow it to, but we don't allow this and this and that. And by then, Facebook said, oh no, we are not in that business of censoring. So Facebook had a policy of allowing, Twitter had another policy. My goodness, what did the left do? They asked and say, you guys have to censor Trump. So suddenly, we are in the business of having a private company that is not depending on our vote, it's depending on the stakeholder vote, to actually do censorship. And that's how we are stuck. Is this the best regulation policies that we can have? Well, then we are in trouble. So, basically, we developed several theories that go with that, but I want to finish. And so, you know, I'm sorry not be able to develop more, but I do want to give time to discussions and hopefully for a few questions. But just to tell you that technology is a great equalizer. You know, back then the left said a big demonstration of workers were equal work, equal pay. It sounds right. But then on the agriculture, a woman would bring less cereals cut than a man. And then, therefore, equal work will pay men. It was justifiable and fair to pay less than women. Well, machinery suddenly discovered that actually a woman can produce just as much as a man. So technology actually was and can be a great equalizer. It amplifies your abilities to make nonsense these distinctions of any little details of differentiations that make us better or worse for this or that task. So that is something that we have to keep in roll and guard, and that's it. You know, thank you.